Hey everyone, welcome back. Welcome back to the Letters and Layers podcast. Welcome to any new listeners who may be under the sound of my voice. It's your host, Amaka. It is Sunday morning, December 15th, when I am recording. So you are getting me, if you're listening on publishing day, you're getting me as close to real time as possible. I woke up this morning, did a little bit of reading, and now I'm recording. I didn't necessarily plan this, but I kind of like how it worked out because this is the last episode of the year. I wish I could kind of insert like an applause track here because it's a big accomplishment for me. And that's, if you can see from the title of this episode, that's something we're going to be talking about in the first half. This is the last episode of the year, and I'm so happy to be getting to this point. I have hit the 75 episode mark with this podcast. I think this might be episode 75. I'm going through the process of actually numbering all my episodes from the beginning, but I keep a rough tally in my raw audio files, and I think this might be it. So this isn't really a milestone episode as far as numbers go. 75, you know, it's a round number-ish, but it's not really one that's celebrated. I have been thinking about it a lot, though, because it kind of brings to the forefront for me the fact that my 100th episode is in view. It's in view. And this is not something, honestly, if I think about it too much, I try not to think about it too often because the thought of it makes me want to cry. Because I remember this podcast being just an idea. I was like, I like the concept of podcasting. I think it would be something that I would enjoy. And I want to start it. I've talked about this a few times on the podcast, and I didn't know right away what I wanted to talk about. And it kind of just came to me one day, and I was like, duh, like, talk about my life, talk about books, talk about wellness, mental health, you know, within my professional realm and outside of it. Talk about life lessons, talk about insights, talk about things I think will be helpful for other Black women, because that's what I wanted this podcast to serve. That's who I wanted this podcast to serve. And it's been 3 years since my first episode, and I am about to cross the 75 episode mark. And within the next 12-ish months, I will hit my 100th episode. And even now, still, with it being something that is like within my reach, it is mind-blowing to me that I'm going to hit triple digits with this. I need to move on. I need to move on because I'm starting to get emotional. Yeah, that is amazing. That is amazing. So, yes, I digress, but if you're listening on December 15th, apologies for it being published a little bit late, but like I said, you know, you're catching me as closely to real time as possible. How am I doing? I'm doing good. The last couple of weeks have been very busy. I was in New York for almost 2 weeks. The first week was primarily family focused because of Thanksgiving, and I hadn't been to New York in over a year. So it was great to just be back. It was great to be with family. It was great to, you know, see some of my folks and just be back in the city that I call home. Go to Manhattan, walk around, see some friends, do some exploring. I bought one book at a local bookstore in the city called Books of Wonder. I'll plug it. I actually bought the third installment to Children of Blood and Bone, and it was a signed copy, so that's cool too. And then I bought another book when I went to Connecticut. And my trip to Connecticut was part of the second week of being on the East Coast, which was more work focused. I extended my trip longer than I typically would have because part of my work is based, most all of my work professionally is based on the East Coast, divided into two states. And one of the states is Connecticut, and I was invited to come in person for like a mini retreat of sorts, just to see some of my colleagues in person and touch base and reconnect and have some time together as a small community. So that was the focus of my trip. When I was in Connecticut, I bought another book that I plan on reading. I don't really want to give too many details yet because it might turn into something for the podcast next year, hopefully. Nothing is set in stone, but hopefully we'll see. So yeah, I was on the East Coast for almost 2 weeks, and I came back on Monday the 9th, which was this past Monday, and kind of just hit the ground running with errands and back to work. Honestly, I feel like it wasn't until maybe like Thursday or Friday that I felt like I could kind of relax a little bit. And now here I am. I am thinking about how 2024 went so fast for me, and other people have similar sentiments. I know everyone has a different relationship to time, but for me, it went lightning speed. There were some months where I felt like I couldn't keep up, and like I would blink and it would be April, I'd blink and it'd be May, I'd blink and it'd be June, and I was just like, what is happening? I was like, God, please, what is happening? Can you please slow down time? Can you slow down time a little bit? Because this is a little bit overwhelming. But yeah, I feel like I've gotten my bearings. The travel season is not over for me. I'm taking a quick trip around on during Christmas week to see some friends. It'll be a couple days. And then I'm going abroad in early January. And I'll tell you guys all about the trip. I'm actually going back to Portugal. I don't know why I'm being a little bit vague, but I'm going back to Portugal. I enjoyed myself so much with the trip I took early this year in January that me and my friend and some of her family decided to go back. So, and we have a little bit of a different itinerary this time. So I'm really excited. And we're going back for about the same amount of time too. So between this episode and the January 15th episode, which will be the next episode, a lot would have happened. And, you know, I'm excited to kind of tell you guys how everything went. But yeah, I'm doing well. I can't complain. The end of the year is often a reflective time for me. And I was talking to a friend of mine last week. I was telling her that I think because of how fast 2024 went for me, that I feel like I didn't accomplish anything this year. And it was starting to like cause a little bit of anxiety for me. Because I'm like, really, what did I do? What did I do this year? And honestly, I think part of this is just me. I don't know if I'll ever get to the point where I think what I've done is enough. You know, it's an ongoing struggle. It's an ongoing challenge and journey for me to constantly remind myself that how I am, who I am, is enough. I really, you know, attaching productivity to my value as a person will be a lifelong journey of enlightenment and improvement and progress. But I still do it. I still do it. I think honestly, part of the success of maturing as an adult and improving your sense of self-awareness is just knowing when you're doing certain things so that you don't maybe enter into a spiral, or it doesn't get worse, or you don't get down on yourself. You know, I think that process of maturing and shedding old behaviors and ways of thinking becomes evident, where you start to kind of find yourself back in that place, but you don't let it get to its worst state, you know? Because maybe me a few years ago would have been like, what did I accomplish this year? Maybe I would get down on myself, or I get really sad or whatever. But kind of thinking, having that distortion of thought, honestly, is what I'll call it. I was self-aware enough to be like, girl, that's not true. And even my friend was like, girl, that's not true. Like, you did this, this, and this. Like, even me, who is your friend, can tell you, you did this. So I was like, you know what? Let me, because I love a good notebook. I love free handwriting. I was like, let me open a notebook and just write down the things. Let me just write down the things that have been accomplishments for me this year. And off the top, within about 5 minutes, I put down like 16 things that have been huge for me this year. And, you know, that averages out to one-ish, a little bit more than one accomplishment a month. And I think that's pretty amazing, because if you're able to accomplish things, you know, outside of the demands of daily life, just surviving and getting through the day, even that alone, depending on where you are in life and what you're going through, sometimes surviving the day is enough, more than enough. But because everybody is in different places in their life, some people have more capacity to do more. And, you know, that does not speak negatively to anyone else who has less capacity. Like I said, it depends on where you are in life. But I was able to kind of put down some things that I got done. And I was like, look, girl, you're tripping, because look at all that you've accomplished with God's help, of course. So I want to share a few. I want to share a few. And then we're going to talk about chapter 8 in All About Love, which I really enjoyed. And I'm going to read a lot from the chapter, because I feel like there's so much of it that's so relevant to today and is actually, you know, kind of like timeless advice, especially for women and Black women. Yeah, so I want to share some of my accomplishments. I feel like they kind of fall into different buckets, like professional accomplishments, personal accomplishments. And, you know, it kind of helped me in doing this quick exercise. I literally just did it before a recording. It helped me to kind of put things in perspective that, you know, even when I feel like things aren't happening, things are happening. Something that has been coming to my mind more often has been that a lot of times life is about waiting. Oftentimes life is about finding contentment and satisfaction in seasons of waiting. Because oftentimes we're waiting for something to happen to kind of propel us to the next step, propel us forward to what we have to do next. And I wonder if maybe I'm confusing my seasons of waiting in this year with I didn't do anything, because there were a lot of seasons of waiting. And seasons don't have to be months. You know, I'm not really thinking seasons like winter and spring. I'm thinking more of like a month or a week or even a couple days. Sometimes you do something and you can't move forward until something else happens that's kind of out of your control. And you're like, okay, God, I've done my part now. I need you to do the rest. I need you to propel me to the next step so I can continue the work I need to do, because we're working together. I like to think that God and my relationship with God is walking alongside me. And then I get to the point where, and God in my relationship with him, and I use him in a very general sense, in my relationship with him has given me tools to where he won't move until I get my work done. And then once
I've gotten to the point where now I have to wait. He will now do the work he needs to do to get me to the next point, to where I have the tools to continue. I hope that makes sense. So I feel like, and this is just, honestly, I kind of was more aware of this year, but I think this has been a theme of my life, that there have been points where I kind of can't do much more until God does what he needs to do to get me to the next point. And then in those moments, no matter how long they take, I have to be content with kind of just waiting, kind of just chilling. And I think that's life. That's a lot of what life is, just being happy, at peace, content in seasons of waiting, in moments where you have to just wait and there's not much else you can do until God does what he needs to do. And then he shows you, okay, I'm done for now. You have the tools. Keep going. So I don't want to confuse my seasons and moments of waiting this year with not having done anything. And I think that's kind of maybe what was happening for a moment, for a second. And, you know, thank God for my friend who kind of told me, listen, girl, I can name this one thing, which is huge, that you did. And if there's nothing else you did this year, this is enough. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to make a list. So I'm going to share a few. And a couple of them, more than a couple, I've probably talked about on the podcast. Like, one accomplishment is personally focused, and it was like a breakthrough as far as my relationship with my father. The episode earlier this fall titled Healing Paternal Wounds talked about a conversation I had with my dad and my brother, to where we were able to move past a lot of the hurt that I felt, because he acknowledged and apologized for a lot of things that have happened over the years. And that was a huge breakthrough for me, because that's one thing I thought would never happen. Honestly, I thought I would just have to be okay with how things are, unfortunately, and just do my best moving forward. But that was a huge, huge breakthrough personally, and I consider that a major accomplishment. Not really anything I precipitated. It's really just God who did it. But yeah, that's big. That's big for me. Another one, which is personal, is my 3-year podcast anniversary that I, you know, that came in September. That is huge. And, you know, I was just talking about how I'm at the 75th episode and 100 is in reach. And it is just, it sounded like an impossible feat at a point, but now it is within reach, which is insane to me. Insane. So that's a huge accomplishment for me. And I've had like great professional accomplishments. As a psychiatric nurse practitioner, I'm licensed in New York and Connecticut. I achieved licensure in the state of Illinois, which is where I live right now. That's big. So now I'm officially licensed in 3 states. I'm working towards being able to practice entirely independently as a nurse practitioner in the state of Illinois. Because it's one thing to be licensed, and then it's another thing to be licensed and practice independently. You don't have to be under the supervision of a doctor or anything like that. So I'm working on that now. And I think it's an accomplishment on its own to be able to get to this point in my career to where I'm able to practice independently as a mental health provider within the scope of diagnosis, within the scope of therapy, within the scope of medication management, to be able to do that on my own and not have to be supervised by a doctor, a psychiatrist, what have you. So yeah, this year is 3 years since graduating from Yale, which is huge too. And you know, I am thinking about what my career looks like moving forward. I'm thinking about where I'd want to be at the 5-year mark, at the 10-year mark. I don't want to think too far ahead, but I am I'm pleased about where I am right now. And that's a huge accomplishment for me. A couple more accomplishments are also more personal to, you know, I was able to go to Portugal in January. I had never been there. So like being able to put a pin in another country is huge for me. And now I'm going back again in a couple weeks because I went and I loved the city of Lisbon. And I'm going to do some more exploring of the country this time around. I went to Panama for my birthday for the second time. I've been to Panama. I went for the first time in 2016. I love the country. And I feel like if I were to move anywhere out of the United States, my first choice would probably be Panama if I wanted to stay on this side of the world. And then probably Portugal if I wanted to kind of move across the pond. But yeah, I was able to take 2 international trips this year, which is huge. And I hope to take a couple more. I think just based off of the rough timeline of 2025, I think I'm actually going to take 3 trips next year internationally, which is great. Yeah, so travel is a love of mine. And that's something I want to do more. So being able to kind of have that be a part of my life this year to varying degrees, like domestically and internationally, I consider an accomplishment. Some other personal things that I consider accomplishments is things I've been thinking about doing for a while, but hadn't pulled the trigger. And I apologize if you hear some barking, but I got my hair locked. And that was huge for me. If you listen to the last episode, I shared my essay that I wrote for a literary competition that didn't get selected, but I love the essay. It's my essay. So I shared it. And it kind of talks about my journey with my hair from childhood and, you know, kind of how I got to this point to deciding I want to lock my hair. And I've talked about it, you know, over the last couple months worth of episodes since I have locked it. I think late September is when I locked it. So it's been like 2.5 months now. And you know, I think now was the time to do it, but I'm so happy that I wish I did it sooner, if that makes sense. So as far as appearance goes, which is something that I've been kind of thinking about, because I know a lot of times culturally, societally, if you put effort into your appearance, it's kind of like a tightrope you have to walk. You know, you're expected to want to look good or take care of yourself. But if you kind of go a little too far, then people start to judge you. So this year I decided I wanted to kind of take things a little bit to the next level and make a few changes, you know. So locking my hair was one, getting braces. I've had braces on for 2 months. So that's something else I wanted to do to enhance my appearance. And I feel like there's nothing wrong with that. When you look good, you feel good, period. I don't care what anybody says. When you look good, you feel good. If you have things about yourself you want to improve, do it. Do it. I know there are instances where many of us would agree that there might be extreme cases, but I think within reason, even plastic surgery, like I know people personally who have done plastic surgery and they are happy with the results. People who are very close to me. So it's not like, oh, I know this person. No, people very close to me who have done plastic surgery and wish they did it sooner. When you look good, you feel good. If there are things that you want to do that you believe will help you appreciate how you look more, enhance your natural beauty, then do it. Do it. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. Within reason, like I said, there are extreme cases, but I think the average person, I'm thinking more me, someone like me, a Black woman like me. If there's something that you want to do, do it. If it's within your means, do it. I'm encouraging you, do it. If no one else is encouraging you, I am encouraging you. You know, as long as you're taking the right steps, you're doing the research, you know, you're making an informed decision. Do it. don't consider what anybody else thinks. So, you know, locking my hair, getting my braces. I discovered a love for walking this year. I'm thankful for Chicago for that. Being able to live in a walkable city to where you're able to get to many points of Chicago with public transportation helped me to discover a love of walking. It has helped me with, you know, my health and physical fitness, which in turn adds to feeling good and liking how I look. So yeah, those are just a few things that I have done this year that I think are worth mentioning. I started reading my Bible more this year. And I think that, not I think, I know. I know that contributes to the closeness to God that I'm starting to feel more of. And yeah, I think I'll stop there. I encourage you, write down a list of accomplishments. Like, take a few minutes, sit down, get a pen and paper. If you want to do it on your phone, that's fine. I'm one to encourage pen and paper, though. I believe in transfer of energy when it comes to what you're feeling to paper. There is something bigger than us that happens when you do that, in my personal opinion. So if you're able, grab a pen and paper from January, just slowly write down what you remember. Nothing is too small. Nothing is too small. If it's just a matter of I survived this year, 2024, that's good enough. That's good enough. I appreciate y'all, you know, indulging me while I share this, because I think it was an important exercise for me to do so that I can see everything that has happened this year that I was able to do, that God did for me, everything. So I'm thankful. I'm thankful for everything. I'm thankful for you guys. I'm thankful for everyone who pressed play on this podcast. And, you know, whether it was a minute, whether it was an entire episode, you decided to spend time with me. I'm thankful for that too. So with that, let's move on. I wanted to talk about All About Love today. We are on chapter 8. And honestly, this might be my favorite chapter of the book so far. I just really, really appreciated what Bell Hooks was focusing on in this chapter. She talked a lot about the importance of extended family. She talked a lot about the importance of a village, being raised in a village, even though that's something that's very hard to come by in American society where I live and where I grew up and everything. She talked about the importance of prioritizing friendships, which is something I've talked about on the podcast too. Like I said, I think I'm going to do quite a bit of reading from this chapter because there's a lot that she discussed and I kind of just want to share with you guys word for word and then expound upon it a little bit. So she begins at the start of the chapter by kind of defining community and using a reference from M. Scott Peck in his book, The Different Drum, Community Making and Peace. And he kind of defines community by saying, in and through community lies the salvation of the world. Peck defines community as the coming together of a group of individuals who have learned how to communicate honestly with each other, whose relationships go deeper than their masks of composure, and who have developed some significant commitment to rejoice together, mourn together, and to delight in each other and make others' conditions our own. So I think, you know, it goes without saying that there's so much importance in community. And I think it's something that you have to really make effort to build as an adult, because if you don't, or if it kind of falls by the wayside and you don't really notice it happening, it can mean finding yourself in a place of extreme loneliness. It can find yourself in a place where you accept things in a romantic relationship that you wouldn't otherwise. And she talks about that in this chapter too. You can find yourself in a place where you are less forgiving. So yeah, let's move on. Let's continue, because I think the more I share, the clearer the insight will be. So she continues on page 130. So I'm going to read. Much of the talk about family values in our society highlights the nuclear family, one that is made up of mother, father, and preferably one or two children. In the United States, this unit is presented as the primary and preferable organization for the parenting of children, one that will ensure everyone's optimal well-being. Of course, this is a fantasy image of family. Hardly anyone in our society lives in an environment like this. Even individuals who are raised in nuclear families usually experience it as merely a small unit within a larger unit of extended kin. Capitalism and patriarchy together as structures of domination have worked overtime to undermine and destroy this larger unit of extended kin. Replacing the family community with a more privatized, small, autocratic unit helped increase alienation and made abuses of power more possible. It gave absolute rule to the father and secondary rule over children to the mother. By encouraging the segregation of nuclear families from the extended family, women are forced to become more dependent on an individual man and children more dependent on an individual woman. It is this dependency that became and is the breeding ground for abuses of power. The failure of the patriarchal nuclear family has been utterly documented, exposed as dysfunctional more often than not, as a place of emotional chaos, neglect, and abuse. Only those in denial continue to insist that this is the best environment for raising children. While I do not want to suggest that extended families are not as likely to be dysfunctional, simply by virtue of their size and their inclusion of non-blood kin, i.e. individuals who marry into the family and their blood relations, they are diverse and so are likely to include the presence of some individuals who are both sane and loving. So I think this was an interesting way to start the chapter. So she's pretty much saying that the nuclear family has its function. Obviously, a nuclear family is a nuclear family for a reason, but there's so much value in having extended family. There are certain examples that you won't be able to see, certain ways of interacting with people and certain dynamics that you're unable to witness, provided it's a healthy space. If it's just your nuclear family, growing up around family who's not your immediate blood is where you start to form the idea of a bigger community outside of your mother, your father, and siblings, if you have them. And like she said, if there's a degree of dysfunction in your immediate family, there is a chance that if you're living in community, you're able to see other examples of love in a healthier sense. It's possible. But because of kind of the way the American family is structured, it's difficult. It's more difficult to live around extended family. The American society, in my opinion, is built on the nuclear family. It's built on when you grow up and become an adult, the messages that we are inundated with is that you find the love of your life. You literally leave and abandon everything. You become one with them, essentially. And you go on this quest of having children. And then you have built your own nuclear family that you now have to work to sustain. And I agree that the nuclear family, in the American sense, is a way of continuing the system that we live in, as far as capitalism is concerned, because you have to work to maintain the nuclear family. You have to work to provide a safe living. You know, you have to work to support the children that you have. And that burden can be heavy, you know, as a nuclear family, as someone who has to support a nuclear family. And with that, you have less time to take care of yourself, to address your needs emotionally, mentally. You take more as far as mistreatment. You might take more in the name of needing to support your nuclear family. And oftentimes, if you have to, unfortunately, this kind of depends on having extended family that are good people that live near you, that are willing to help you that are genuine, that embody love in its truest sense. Having that kind of relieves some of that burden, because you're able to share the responsibilities. I think now about how it's so hard for women in American society to make the transition from womanhood only to womanhood and motherhood, because a lot of us know the adage, it takes a village, but I wrote in the margins of this excerpt, where is the village? If you're not able to pay for the village, as in caretaking, babysitters, you know, support, help, oftentimes people don't have that. And they have to do everything themselves, which is honestly not the way it should be. This is where the essence of community is so important. But unfortunately, a lot of us don't have that. Unfortunately, a lot of us were not able to grow up with cousins, aunts and uncles, grandparents. Some of us were. I, to a degree, was able to do that. And I am so appreciative of being able to do that. But not everyone gets that. And like I said, if you're not aware of it, and it's not really anyone's fault, because just the way we're brought up in American society, it's like you don't even know when it happens. You don't even know when you go from having people around you to kind of being by yourself. And now it is a situation where things that are to your detriment have easier access to you, where you will start to feel a little lonelier, where you will start to idolize romantic relationships to the point where maybe you are accepting things you shouldn't. So there's a lot that can happen. I will continue, especially about that piece where you start accepting things in romantic relationships that you shouldn't, because part of the messaging that we are, you know, that we internalize is that marriage is the peak. Marriage is the ultimate goal. And you almost have to do whatever it takes to get there. I'm skipping around a little bit, but I think what she says on page 134, I think speaks to this. So she writes, most of us are raised to believe we will either find love in our first family, our family of origin, or if not there, in the second family we're expected to form through committed romantic couplings, particularly those that lead to marriage and or lifelong bondings. Many of us learn as children that friendship should never be seen as just important as family ties. However, friendship is the place in which a great majority of us have our first glimpse of redemptive love and caring community. Learning to love in friendships empowers us in ways that enable us to bring this love to other interactions within family or with romantic bonds. So in the beginning of this excerpt, she talks about how if we don't find the community and love of our, you know, within our first family, we are conditioned to want to find it in romantic relationships. And that's what we are primed to epitomize and to, you know, go for. And with that, that opens up space to rationalize certain behavior that should be unacceptable in romantic relationships and excuse things that we wouldn't otherwise excuse in friendships, which I will talk about shortly. I want to dive a little bit deeper into the behavior that we accept in romantic relationships if we do not have the right community around us from the beginning. So she talks more about this on page 136. One of the longest romantic relationships of my life was one in which I behaved in the more traditional manner of placing it above all other interactions. When it became destructive, I found it difficult to leave. I found myself accepting behavior, verbal and physical abuse, that I would not have tolerated in a friendship. I had been raised conventionally to believe this relationship was special and should be revered above all. Most women and men born in the 50s or earlier were socialized to believe that marriages and or committed romantic bonds of any kind should take precedence over all other relationships. Had I been evaluating my relationship from a standpoint that emphasized growth rather than duty and obligation, I would have understood that abuse irreparably undermines bonds.
All too often, women believe it is a sign of commitment, an expression of love, to endure unkindness or cruelty, to forgive and forget. In actuality, when we love rightly, we know that the healthy, loving response to cruelty and abuse is putting ourselves out of harm's way. Even though I was a committed feminist as a young woman, all that I knew and believed in politically about equality was, for a time, overshadowed by a religious and familial upbringing that had socialized me to believe everything must be done to save, quote, the relationship. And I wrote after that, it benefits the man. Because it does. It does. She focused on a couple generations before me. I believe it's the boomers, the baby boomer generation. I feel like it has been a little bit less with generations after that, but the grip is still there. We are still as women, and we are still as Black women from childhood. We are slowly and very elusively taught. We don't really know what's happening. But you wake up one day in your 40s and 50s and you're like, what happened? Where we prioritize the relationship over ourselves. And to a degree, it doesn't even matter what's happening. This is where emotional abuse can come up. This is where physical abuse can develop. And she pretty much spells it out plainly here because of that conditioning from childhood as women to deny our needs and deny ourself and deny our humanity and sacrifice that for, quote, the relationship, keeping the family together, doing it for the kids. Which personally, I don't think is always the right decision or ever really. But like I said, just my personal opinion, especially if you are not happy and have not been happy for a very long time. Yeah, so I wanted to make sure I read this part because I think so many women can relate. And if they can't relate directly, they know a woman who can relate. And being in a situation like this, like I said, you are much more likely to forgive things from a romantic partner that you would never forgive from a friend. There is so much grace that we give to romantic partners, which then in turn keeps us in relationships much longer than we should be, that we would not give, as far as grace, we would not give to friends that they are probably more deserving of, because everyone makes mistakes and redemption is in the action that you take, you know, to make things better and to repair the damage that has been done. But a lot of times we don't even allow friendships to get to that point where if a mistake is made, we offer forgiveness, we offer grace. We don't give oftentimes friendships the opportunity to grow to a place where repair is made and the relationship, as in the friendship, is made stronger. She talks about this too. She says also on page 134, going into 135, often we take friendships for granted, even when they are the interactions where we experience mutual pleasure. We place them in a secondary position, especially in relation to romantic bonds. This devaluation of our friendships creates an emptiness we may not see when we are devoting all our attention to finding someone to love romantically or give all our attention to a chosen loved one. Committed love relationships are far more likely to become codependent when we cut off all our ties with friends to give these bonds we consider primary our exclusive attention. And then on page 138, I want to continue with this quote towards the bottom of the page. Within a loving community, we sustain ties by being compassionate and forgiving. Eric Butterworth's Life is for Loving includes a chapter on love and forgiveness. Insightfully, he writes, "We cannot endure without love, and there is no other way to the return of healing, comforting, harmonizing love than through total and complete forgiveness. If we want freedom and peace and the experience of love and being loved, we must let go and forgive. Forgiveness is an act of generosity. It requires that we place releasing someone else from the prison of their guilt or anguish over our feelings of outrage or anger. By forgiving, we clear a path on the way to love. It is a gesture of respect
True forgiveness requires that we understand the negative actions of another. So I thought it was important to provide this context of, you know, forgiveness as a concept, because it's not something that I feel like we talk enough about. And I feel like we also internalize messages, especially in younger generations, I think. I could be wrong. That if someone does you wrong, you cut them off. You don't give any room for understanding or compassion. You know, we're at that time of the year. We're at that time of the year on social media where you'll see these posts like, you know, cutting off people in 2025, cutting off people that don't serve me in 2025 or whatever. And I find those posts so funny because it's made to be cool to not extend grace to people who may have done you wrong. And, you know, obviously too, like, their context is key. If this is somebody who has repeatedly, you know, taken advantage of your kindness and are not appreciating you for the friend or partner that you are, then it's probably in your best interest to distance yourself or discontinue communication. I'm talking about relationships and friendships, primarily friendships right now. I'm talking about friendships where there is one misunderstanding and the people in the friendship don't know how to move forward because they don't know how to extend forgiveness, and people are sitting in their anger and their ego, and one person doesn't want to, you know, restart conversation and try and get to a point of understanding. We are taught to do that. We're taught to try and make things work more so in relationships. But as far as friendships go, we are not taught to try and make things work as friends. And like I said, it depends on the situation. If this is someone who is repeatedly taking advantage of you, maybe it's a good idea to distance yourself. Maybe it's a good idea to end that relationship or friendship. But if this is an ongoing friendship that has been positive in your life, that has changed your life for the better, and there was a misunderstanding, this is where forgiveness might need to be practiced. This is where you think about how can grace be extended. This is where you think about how can you bridge where you are to where your friend is, to where you guys can get to a point of being on the same page again. You know, if the friend's intentions were not to hurt you, are you able to understand why they did what they did? You know, are you able to give them another chance? If you were the friend who committed the act or, you know, did the thing that was wrong, wouldn't you want compassion? Wouldn't you want understanding? Wouldn't you want forgiveness? If you're the one in that position and you value that person's friendship, wouldn't you want them to extend you grace? I know I would. So this is, you know, so much to think about because it goes against a lot of what we are raised to think and how to behave. You know, I keep saying that we are raised to continuously forgive our significant other, whether they cheat, whether they have a baby outside of the relationship, whether they do all types of stupid shit. We're raised to see their humanity and forgive them. But if friends, you know, do something wrong, we are not encouraged to continue the friendship. Because at the end of the day, the goal is to value only the romantic unit. But I would venture to say friendships are just as important. Friendships are just as important as romantic relationships. Maybe even a little bit more important. I don't care.
I don't care. I know that I value my friendships more now as someone who is happily married than before I was married. I value them now more so. And I feel like other married women could probably relate. It is a way of practicing forgiveness outside of romantic relationship. And it's a way of continuing to keep the community together. It's a way of continuing to lead and live with love. And I think that's, you know, a goal that we should all be working towards. So I think this is a good place to end the podcast. I just crossed 1 hour of recording. And I think, I feel settled as far as ending it here. So I want to thank you guys for listening. I want to thank you guys for being with me throughout this year, 2024. I appreciate you guys so much. I know I said it earlier on in the episode, but I'm going to say it again because it bears repeating. If you listened to even just a minute of this podcast this year, if you found me this year, if you are a longtime listener, I appreciate you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. As always, feel free to reach out to me at contact@theLettersAndLayers.com, my email. I'm also on Instagram @Amaka_AG. Please share this episode or past episodes. Please rate, please review if you love this show. If this episode or past episodes have positively impacted you, please recommend. Do all the things. Thank you guys. I hope you have a great holiday season. Happy New Year in advance. And we will meet again in 2025. All right. Thank you, guys. Take care. Bye.